Very relaxing.
Right now it is time for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, who joins us on a Monday morning here on The Breakfast Club on Robinhood Radio. And we say good morning to the maven. Good morning.
Good morning. We have a nice overcast morning here.
Well, it's the same thing.
Too much sun is very painful.
Well, we had fog this morning, so.
Still did.
Well, same thing here. Yeah. Anyway, let me do a little reporting. Let's start with, I did, in fact, make the sauerkraut soup that I talked about last week, something known as Jurek in Poland, but not here. It was a specialty of what I like to call Polish coffee shops, which basically are, you know, have a diner-type menu, except they also have Polish specialties, one of which is always at the one or two that are left.
So how did it turn out?
A restaurant form from the 1970s and 80s, maybe went into the 90s even. But there is one called Teresa's on Montague Street in Brooklyn Heights. Anyway, they also have pierogi and kielbasi things.
Yeah, but how
did soups, including a sauerkraut soup.
How did yours turn out?
Pardon me?
How did yours turn out?
You're rushing the punchline.
Listen, it was thrilling. It wasn't perfect. It was thrilling because I'm always nervous about making my own recipes, that there's some mistake in the directions or whatever. But the recipe appears in a brand-new book called The Bread and the Knife, A Life in 26 Bites. And it also appears in my book, New York City Food, because it's a bit of history, this recipe. And it also appears in my book, Soup Suppers, because it can be a meal in a bowl. And I guess ours was. Well, we had some bread, but it's a sauerkraut broth. I'm not going to go through the recipe again, but just to say I followed my own recipe to the letter, and it came out exactly as it should, even to the point of boil this, and you should result in 5 cups of liquid, and it did.
That's a very good recipe.
By the way, it freezes perfectly, so if you have an afternoon to make a little chicken broth, a quick chicken broth with chicken legs I made it with, just as the recipe said, and then you boil up sauerkraut and make a sauerkraut broth, and you combine them, and you serve it with a potato and kielbasi, so it is a meal.
And I just want to say about soup suppers that
yes.
Because I found it accidentally in a place and I snagged it. I think I told you this a couple of years ago when I did that. The recipes are actually how do you say this? The recipes are great and the meals.
I keep rediscovering the recipes in that book and Soup Suppers. By the way, my biggest selling book. I've written 7 books, and that's the sold the most copies of any. Still in print. You can buy it on Amazon, I think, $16 or something.
But the more important thing is that it's almost misnamed, because the way that people eat now, it's not supper. It's a meal.
Let me just say, it wasn't then either.
Okay.
It was a cute title.
It is an adorable title.
I'll tell you how it happened, even. I was walking down the street with my then editor, Susan Friedland, and she said, I just purchased this. She just acquired a book from a famous bread baking teacher who is German, maybe was German, and she wanted to do a book of bread and soup. Well, that seemed normal to me. And Susan said, well, the only problem is, what do you call it? You can't just say soup and bread. I said, well, you can call it Soup Suppers. She said, that's a nice title. Why don't you write that book?
So
that's how that happened. But walking the street trying to figure out a next project for me. And at that point, I was living in an apartment that only had a 2-burner electric cooktop. So, and no oven. So what was I going to do? You know, what kind of food? And I was a restaurant critic, so I wasn't even home that much for meals. So I did entertain by making big pot of soup, give them, bread and cheese and a salad and some nice wine, and nobody ever complains. So the other day I had my car repaired, and I go to a Palestinian-owned and mechanic, and no, all the mechanics are either some kind of Middle Eastern or Moroccan. So So my Moroccan mechanic says to me, "Oh, do you ever eat harira?" Now harira is the standard Moroccan soup. And I said, "Yeah, not only do I make it every once in a while, but I wrote a good recipe for it in my soup book." So now he's curious, and I have to make harira for him, bring him some harira for lunch one day soon, and then he'll give me his opinion.
Is that the sort of harira thing? Does that give you performance? That's the sort of thing that makes me like, oh my God.
What?
Does that make you nervous when you do that?
No, not at all.
Okay.
No, I know the recipe. I mean, I know I like this recipe. But this is the thing about harira, that it's totally regional.
Exactly.
Every part of Morocco, probably every cook, every home cook makes it a little different. I ate it a lot in Morocco because I was traveling literally back roads. And in these roadside souks or markets, even in the Atlas Mountains, that's what you eat, bread and harira. So I don't even remember where I got my harira recipe from, but it's very rich. I'm looking at it now. I got this recipe from a restaurant that doesn't exist anymore called Latfi. It was a Moroccan man and his British wife.
Sue Rabaj. Abdel Rabaj and Sue Rabaj.
You knew them?
Yes, I did.
Oh, well, there you go. So this, my harira recipe in Soup Suppers is from him.
Okay, well,
yeah.
I knew Abdel.
The restaurant, their son, they went back to Morocco at some point.
But their son is Latfi.
The restaurant was named for their son, Latfi.
Right.
By the time they went back to Morocco, he was an adult, young adult, and he took over the restaurant. But I think what happened is, you know, it was Restaurant Row, and they probably got a rent increase that they couldn't.
What happened is Abdel died.
Oh, but
suddenly
he was in Morocco already.
Quite suddenly, yes. They were actually
her name
just.
Sue, what's her name? Susan.
Her name is Sue. Sue Baker. Sue Rabaj.
Sue.
Yep.
Yeah, they were lovely, lovely people.
Lovely.
How
lovely.
Did you know them?
It's a long story, and I think that we can do a memory lane later.
Okay.
But anyway, that's it. So,
they were lovely people, and it was the best Moroccan restaurant New York ever saw.
Yep.
As far as I know. I mean, I hear about a Moroccan restaurant I run.
It just.
But I have a Moroccan neighbor.
Okay.
She lives upstairs from me, and she and her Puerto Rican husband are wonderful cooks. And when I see her on the street, she walks the dog in the afternoon. And I bumped into her the other day, and we started talking about mishwi. You know mishwi? Is the Moroccan roast lamb. I don't know what the word mishwi means, but you basically are long and slow roasting with a spice mixture, which I'm sure also varies from kitchen to kitchen. But I told her some weeks ago about this spice mixture that I found in the net cost flyer that I've been making on lamb. And she said, that sounds a lot like mishwi seasoning. So I've said Central Asian, but it's possible it's Moroccan. So moving on, but speaking of soup, finally, you know, it's cool enough that I can actually turn the heat on for us and the oven or the burners.
The burners.
So I made... only because I had a craving for beans. And the bean that is the health, the three beans, I should say, that are the three legumes that are really the healthiest are lentils, chickpeas, interestingly, the two old world legumes. They're mentioned in the Bible. And black beans, which are new world. So I have, there was a sale on canned black beans, the Goya brand that I like to buy when I buy canned beans. And it was like 89 cents a can. So, of course, I bought a bunch of cans. And I made a soup the other day, really, real quickie in my book. It turned out sensationally well. The two cans of beans was enough for Bob and me for two meals. The first time we had it, a soup garnished with diced avocado and scallion. And the second time we had it over rice with some leftover chicken and a salsa. It was really good. I made my own salsa. So, I mean, it's nothing. It's just diced tomato. In my case, it was just diced tomato, sliced scallion, some lime juice, and I didn't put coriander in it, but I wish I had. So the soup is one large green pepper came out to a cup and a half cut into quarter-inch dice, into a pretty fine dice. You know, of course, you take out the seeds and the ribs and make sure you take the ribs out. They're sort of bitter. And you cut it into thin strips, and then you cut across the thin strips, and you've got your dice. Then 1.5 cups of similarly chopped, cut, diced onion. I happen to have one large sweet onion, so I used it, but I think this would be with any onion. Red onion, yellow onion, white onion, doesn't matter. But 1.5 cups of onion. And I thought I needed a little fresh taste, so I put in one large rib of celery, similarly diced. That came out to about 1/2 cup. And I sautéed these. I didn't sauté. I put 1/4 cup of olive oil in a saucepan, and a big saucepan, like a 3-quart saucepan. And I, what the chefs say, sweat the vegetables. I put in the vegetables, tossed them. Oh, 3 large cloves of garlic, chopped, as relatively fine. And I put all that into the saucepan with the oil, tossed it in the oil, covered the pot, and let it steam in its own juices, the vegetables, for about 15 minutes, at which point they were quite tender. If you want to stretch it to 20 minutes, but don't do it over high heat. You don't want them to, you don't want them to fry. You want them to steam and exude their juices. Excuse me. And then I added my 2 cans of beans with all the liquid in the can, and 1 can full of water. This soup, by the way, if you wanted to say it's vegan. In the old days, we just said it was vegetarian. And certainly, if you put chicken on the leftovers, it's neither. And if you put cheese, however, on the soup, which would be good, you know, any cheddar cheese, jack cheese. I like cheese with flavor. I don't really like the super bland Mexican cheese. But anyway, it's vegan or vegetarian. So you put in the water and then season with 1/2 teaspoon of cumin and a nice rounded tablespoon of tomato paste. If you don't have really, really thick tomato paste, I mean, if you have really thick tomato paste, as I do, you're going to have to thin it out a little bit in a dish with some of the hot water from the soup, you know, liquid from the soup, and just sort of mash the paste until it dissolves into the water, because you don't want little lumps of tomato paste. But if you use canned American tomato paste, it should dissolve pretty easily. And I think the tomato is really essential. It's my form of MSG. You know, tomato is a flavor enhancer, and it also gives the soup a tinge of color. And that's it. And then I let it simmer for about 15-20 minutes. That's all you need. The beans are already cooked. You just want everything to mingle. I would say that if you're making this ahead, 15-20 minutes is just fine, and then you reheat it and let it simmer another 5 minutes. And I thought it was great just as is, as soup. You could put an herb in here. If you have Mexican oregano, that would be the perfect thing, I would think. But even a pinch of Sicilian oregano is good. If you want to serve it with some garnishes, as I said, diced avocado is terrific. A scallion is terrific. Grated cheese, like cheddar, is terrific. And cilantro, if you like cilantro. That's the love-hate herb. People say it makes them sick.
Yes.
Or people say, I'm addicted. It goes both ways.
Why can't you just have dill?
Dill?
Dill
is good.
No, no, I don't.
I keep thinking that this is more Latino.
I wasn't volunteering dill for the dish. I was just, I am one of the cilantro people that...
Well, you don't need anything. I mean, but really a pinch of oregano, or even, as I mentioned last week, marjoram, which is a sort of a mild form of oregano, that would be really good. And in fact, I have to say, when I reheated the beans for the second meal, I had them in the fridge for several days, and then yesterday for lunch, I heated them up. By the way, you could put in a little hot pepper in here or serve it with hot sauce. So I heated it up, and I put in some shredded leftover chicken breast and made a little salsa, and I poured the beans and chicken over rice and put the salsa on top. It was really good. And I added a pinch of oregano and the lime juice. I must say, the second time around, Bob said, "Oh, I love your use of lime juice." I had a laugh at that expression. So anyway, really good soup. Really, really good soup.
I had a really random question.
And handy, because it's very healthy, as I pointed out.
Arthur, random question.
Yes, no, random. Go ahead.
Okay. Did you have many of the ingredients? Do you keep limes in your house? Do you keep scallions in your house?
I bought a lime yesterday.
Okay.
For this purpose. I keep lemons in the house, but not limes. In the summer, I'm more likely to have limes around because there are some alcoholic beverages that I like with lime.
Right.
So, yeah. But also, I don't know why, when you really want a lemon or really want a lime in the middle of the summer, they're super expensive.
I know, that's bizarre.
But I paid 10 cents for my lime yesterday.
Okay, so do you keep scallion in your house? Do you keep...
I'm a big scallion person, yes. Okay. I did buy scallions fresh yesterday. Truthfully, I've been using up every last bit of food in my freezer and refrigerator. I just felt it was time to, start, have a clean slate. And also, my housekeeper was here on Saturday, and she washed down the refrigerators, so I have really pristine refrigerators now. I say plural because I actually have two under-the-counter refrigerators in the kitchen. But the thing is, I buy fresh food. Remember, I live somewhere where I walk around the corner and I can buy this. I don't even have to get in the car. So I shop every day pretty much for fresh things. But scallions are something you can keep in your crisper for weeks. And if I'm making something that other people might use raw onion, I'm more likely to use raw scallion. It's milder.
Right.
For all those onion phobic people in my life.
That's a good idea, actually. I like scallion.
Yeah,
what, do you use chives a lot?
Scallions. Cipollini in Italian. I love the word in Italian.
Cipollini. What about, do you use chives or no, not so much?
Do I use what?
Chives or not so much?
Chives, never. Hardly ever. Only in the spring, when I had it in my herb garden next to the building. Of course, I use chives a lot in the spring. And chive flowers, I love. One of my favorite things in the spring is a goat cheese omelet with chive flowers. You open up your yellow omelet. There, it's white, purple. It's really nice. And tastes great. No, I don't use chives very much. I must say that when I buy chives in the supermarket, I find they have almost no flavor.
Probably by the time they get...
Jalapeno peppers these days are...
The only thing chives are good for to put in sour cream on a baked potato.
Yeah, but not something I indulge in very often.
That's about the only
thing I just...
I have to bake potato on occasion, but...
I learned that.
I don't fatten it up.
I used to get the waiters really mad at me at the Concord when I used to go with my father, and I used to double the chives on the potato.
Well, yeah, the old Alan King joke is, he looked at the menu and he says, I'll have it.
That's right. People wonder how I got fat. Well, I'll tell you how I
there
got
you
fat.
There you go. Not hard. At those, it's funny you should mention, because with this British food writer that I had dinner with last night, a friend of my cousin, we had to explain the Borscht Belt to her. You know what? This was interesting, I thought. She ordered something that... We went to a restaurant that basically is American food, but she ordered, like, the most American thing as a first course, which was iceberg lettuce with blue cheese and bacon.
Okay.
I expected it to come out as a wedge, but the innovation of this restaurant is that they cut up the lettuce. But that is, like, a really American thing. Before we depart, I want to say today is yet another Jewish holiday. Alternate side of the street parking is suspended in New York City for Shmuni Atzeres, which is, some people say it's the eighth day of Sukkot, which just ended. That's a week-long holiday commemorating the 40 years in the desert. So it's sometimes called the Feast of the Tabernacles, because one of the customs of the holiday is to have a little hut outside to eat in and say prayers in during that 1 week of Sukkot or Sukkot, depending on your generation, you pronounce it differently. The roof of this building, hut, is you're supposed to be able to see the sky through it. So in the old days, I remember when I was a kid, everybody had bamboo on the top. But I went to a Sukkot only a couple of years ago, and they had some kind of fiberglass product. And they were super religious people, too. Anyway, you eat in the Sukkot, but there's no particular food that goes with the Sukkot. But there is a food that is used ritually, and now you can eat it, now that Sukkot is over. This is the eighth, also called the eighth day. Oh, by the way, it commemorates the wandering in the desert for 40 years, but it also commemorates the harvest. And because, we're in harvest time, and that's another reason you eat in the Sukkot, because, it's good weather, it's harvest weather, you celebrate, blah, blah. But today, it's interesting. Today, you pray for rain. Now you don't anymore have to worry about eating in your Sukkot. And if you go, if you drive around Brooklyn, you know you're in an Orthodox community, because every building, even the brand new construction, every apartment has a small terrace where you can put out your Sukkot, your sukkah. The building itself is called a sukkah. So I driving through Williamsburg, you go from Hasidic Williamsburg into hipster Williamsburg, and Broadway is more or less the borderline, but in fact the real border it keeps changing, and you can tell by do the buildings have terraces or not. Yeah,
it's a good rule of thumb. Here you have blow up pumpkins suddenly.
Well, that's going to happen any second. I was taught as a Jewish boy not to celebrate Halloween because it's a pagan and Christian holiday, not a Jewish holiday. And our Hebrew school teacher would warn us with some dire threat as we were dismissed from Hebrew school in the afternoon that we were not to trick-or-treat on the way home.
Well, Lamont's Market brought in last week a tractor-trailer full of huge pumpkins, and I mean huge pumpkins, probably 4 feet high and 2 or 3 feet wide, and they were selling them 2 for $10 for people that want big pumpkins for pumpkin carving. But
For what?
For pumpkin carving.
You've got to make jack-o'-lanterns.
Oh, yeah, jack-o'-lanterns.
But these were huge, and 2 for $10. And I said, they're never going to sell these. Right? I stopped by one. I came back like 3 days later, and there were like 12 cases of these things.
Gone.
People, it's really, the whole supersize thing's a little out of control, but we'll see what happens. Let's try carving those monsters. I ignored it because I love pagan holidays.
Portions do not need to be supersized.
No. Quite right.
And this morning I was looking at my friend Fred Plotkin's Facebook timeline. Fred has recently guided a tour an opera and culinary. He's Mr. Opera, I have to say. Fred is a lecturer at the Metropolitan Opera and all over the place, all over the world, on opera. And he is also a former food writer, there's more money in this issue, there's more money in opera than there is in food writing. But anyway, so Fred knows both very well. Anyway, so Fred was complaining, not complaining, but just observing that he's back home now, and I forgot where he was, but he ordered shrimp and grits with scrambled eggs, and it came out to be like enough food for a family of four. And he says, this is really weird to me, having just spent a couple of weeks in Sicily, where the portions, are small enough that you can have several courses and not feel stuffed. But we really go crazy with portion size here. Most foreigners, I find, are appalled and shocked. Is that the same thing? By portion size here.
Well, you can say shocked and appalled, too. But Marshall's saying we have to
go.
Yeah,
I guess you could be both. Marshall's just in a hurry because it's 8:02. And my time is up.
And on that note.
And next week will be my last week in Brooklyn. And the week after that.
New Orleans.
I'm going to broadcast from New Orleans.
Right. Don't forget this an hour earlier. You'll love that.
I'm not forgetting it. You don't forget it because you're going to call me.
That's true.
All right.
On my cell number.
Okay.
All right, Arthur.
All right, have a great week. It's going to be gorgeous weather, I hear, and cool enough to cook.
All right.
Take care.
Take care. Arthur Schwartz, the Food Maven, here on Robin Hood Radio.
Underwriting support for Arthur Schwartz, the Food Maven, from Hathaway Young, located on South Center Street in Millerton. Flawless catering and event planning, HathawayYoung.com. John Andrews Restaurant on the Hillsdale Road in South Egremont, 413-528-3467. On the web, JARestaurant.com. Rubiner's Cheesemongers and Grocers on Main Street in Great Barrington, 413-528-0488, Rubiner's.com. In Hillsdale, New York, Hillsdale Home Chef with two beautiful teaching classes, and they've got classes to go in those cooking rooms. More information, 518-325-7000, hghshomechef.com. And Haven Cafe in Lenox, Massachusetts, offering quality food and excellent service. From a fresh cup of great coffee to healthy, delicious breakfast, or sit down with a dinner with a tasty, life-enhancing meal that you can take home. Also, they feature catering. Supporting local organic farmers, environmentally conscious, and epicurious distributors, havencafebakery.com.